Case 21-5543, USA versus Joshua Beeson. Argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Parks, you may proceed for the appellant.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Melissa Salinas, and I would like to introduce two law students who will be arguing the case pursuant to your granting the motion. I'm supervising Mr. Andrew Parks and Ms. Erin Woodruff. Thank you.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. We'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
May it please the court, my name is Andrew Parks, and I'm here with my colleague Erin Woodruff on behalf of Joshua Beeson. This case is about the district court's acceptance of Mr. Beeson's guilty plea, despite express concerns that the plea was the product of coercion. By accepting Mr. Beeson's plea without adequately determining that it was voluntary, the district court violated Rule 11 of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure and deprived Mr. Beeson of due process. Furthermore, the district court imposed a substantively unreasonable sentence, in part because the court considered impermissible factors in selecting Mr. Beeson's sentence. And I'll address each of these arguments in turn. The problem in this case, Your Honors, is that the court below didn't adequately inquire into the pressure that Mr. Beeson was receiving from his aunt. And this was uniquely disturbing because the record demonstrates that the aunt's pressure was done not out of concern for Mr. Beeson's best interests, but instead at his expense in order to save her own son, a co-defendant in the case. The court asked Mr. Beeson formulaic questions about his plea's voluntariness.
I mean, this judge did a pretty thorough, it seemed to me he was pretty conscientious about exploring this issue, you know, back in chambers, and he goes back out, and at the end of the process, he's going to ask some questions that, you know, one could say are formulaic, perhaps because he must ask them. But this is a record of conscientiousness on Judge Morris's part, so far as I can tell. Am I missing something?
Respectfully, Your Honor, yes. The judge was aware of and became very concerned about the pressure that Mr. Beeson may have been receiving.
He's aware of it, but you know, people can express concerns without that meaning, oh my goodness, you know, if in the end he goes a different direction, you know, it doesn't mean he's wrong just because he's candid about what he's thinking about, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, the importantly here, Your Honor, the judge never asked Mr. Beeson specific questions about the pressure he received from his aunt. Once he did become concerned in chambers, and the court didn't involve Mr. Beeson in those chambers discussions where those issues were discussed. Everyone expressed that the plea may have been the product of coercion.
I would quarrel with that formulation. And I guess this is maybe my principal concern by your argument on this point, which is that if one reads this record, there's no question Mr. Beeson's going to plead guilty. That the idea of him pleading not guilty and going to trial, I don't see a whiff of that anywhere here. The question is, he's going to plead guilty. That seems to be a fixed fact in this record. The question is whether he is going to follow the advice of his lawyer and do a negotiated plea where he cooperates and testifies against other co-defendants. And gets a shorter sentence, or whether he does what he did in the end, and I guess it was an open plea or whatever, and just pleads guilty and gets sentenced. Nobody's persuading him, you know, to plead guilty. He's already doing that. Is that fair?
I respectfully disagree, Your Honor.
Where is the indication that he actually might go to trial?
Well, in chambers, the prosecution said on page 30 of the change of plea conference in chambers, his aunt and his cousin seem to think it's best that the cousin not have him there. And that's following a discussion about Mr. Beeson going to trial. This is in the context of the court considering whether or not to accept a guilty plea. Whereas if he rejected it, Mr. Beeson would assuredly be proceeding to trial in this case.
I don't understand. I mean, That sounds like, you know, have him there means as a witness.
In the context of that conversation, I have to pull up the full transcript, but they're talking about Mr. Beeson's trial, the record on page 30 of that portion of the transcript.
Do you have anything else that suggests he was actually thinking about going to trial here?
This court is tasked with analyzing the adequacy of this Rule 11 inquiry, and in these circumstances, due process and Rule 11 require more. In McCarthy versus the United States, the Supreme Court held that the nature of the inquiry required by Rule 11 must necessarily vary from case to case, and, quote, matters of reality and not mere ritual should be controlling.
I'll just say one more thing and I'll get out of your way so talk.
No,
I mean, what I'm suggesting is that I don't see anything here that suggests the decision to plead guilty was involuntary or coerced. One could make an argument that he was influenced not to have an agreement alongside it to testify, as opposed to what he did, which is not have any agreement. So the agreement part, he might have felt some pressure, but the plea part, I'm not really seeing that.
And respectfully, Anna, I think we're going to disagree on this one.
That's okay. Tell me why I'm wrong.
Sure. The context of the conversation in chambers was about the court's decision to accept or reject Mr. Beeson's guilty plea.
Right.
About whether or not he's going to go, which involves him, you know, going to trial if you reject it. And the court even asks at one point, do I have to accept this plea? And furthermore, Beeson's statements aren't dispositive in this case in response to some of the formulaic questions. For example, in McCarthy versus the United States, a Supreme Court case, the defendant there had stated that his plea was not the product of threats or coercion or promises, but instead was made of his, quote, own volition. Here, Mr. Beeson did respond to formulaic questions, but this was after the judge was expressing concern that the plea was involuntary, and there was no follow-up about the pressure that Mr. Beeson was receiving.
Mr. Beeson comes across as a very independent actor in this plea hearing. I mean, he is emphatic that he wants to plead guilty and that he does not want to testify. I mean, he really comes across as having made his own decision here, and he's grateful to the court for not giving him a harder time about it. It's really kind of the way it ends up at the end.
Still, this court is tasked with analyzing the adequacy of the Rule 11 inquiry into making that determination that the plea was truly voluntary. And in this case, without asking Mr. Beeson whether or not the pressure from his aunt was affecting that decision, this court today wouldn't be able to make an evaluation of whether or not the plea was truly voluntary, because that question was not asked. If the Rule 11b2, if the record in this case were to comply with Rule 11b2, it would be difficult to read that as anything but meaningless if a judge can become aware of and express concern about voluntariness of a plea and then not ask whether or not that pressure in the case was affecting the choice to plead guilty. And the government cites many cases about family pressure, but this case is uniquely different. I see Judge Clayton.
So the principal problem is that the defendant was not questioning himself about having received pressure from the aunt to plead guilty?
Not after the judge became aware of and concerned about it at all. No, there was no question about the aunt's pressure directly with him. There was conversations in chambers, but Mr. Beeson was not involved in those chambers discussions.
What about the consideration that some would say that family frequently advises relatives about what to do in connection with criminal proceedings, and this is just that kind of case, even if there was a conversation between the aunt and the defendant? Was the problem that the aunt's son had something to gain from the defendant not testifying in any way that would implicate the aunt's son here? Is that really the problem?
That's exactly correct, Your Honor. In the cases that you mentioned, it may be true that family influences a defendant's choice, but In those cases, typically, the pressure is in furtherance of the defendant's best interests. They want to see the defendant receive, you know, shorter time, shorter sentence. They don't want to risk the defendant going to trial and possibly seeing a life sentence or, and so forth. That was the case in Gassaway and Evans, which are cases that the government cites in their brief. In this case, the exact opposite was true. The pressure was against Mr. Beeson's best interest because the aunt was trying to sacrifice him in order to save her own son. Furthermore, in those cases where family pressure has been involved, the allegation of coercion is merely an allegation, whereas here the government acknowledges in chambers that they have phone calls between the aunt and Mr. Beeson where they say that we listen and we know the influence that she has. So sort of this proof here, it's specific, and it's against his best interest, and that's why we think it's meaningfully different.
That's a good point about there having been these phone calls, but what are we to make of the fact that the transcript of the phone calls have not been offered subsequent to the plea colloquy on behalf of the defendant? We know a lot more about the problem here if we had transcripts of the calls between the aunt and the defendant, then nobody seemed to have tried to put those into the record that we were going to look at on appeal.
Sure. We have not reviewed those either. We don't have those, but that would have been an important thing if the judge was truly concerned, as he expressed he was in chambers, about the plea's voluntariness, that he could have made a more elaborate inquiry with Mr. Beeson or tried to get access and learn more about the substance of those calls, because that is crucial to determining whether or not the pressure that's discussed actually affected Mr. Beeson's choice to plead guilty. What the judge did in most cases would have been fine, but in this case, when they're aware of and concerned about whether or not the plea is voluntary, it just couldn't be okay here. And for these reasons, we'd ask that the court vacate.
Last question before you sit down, if that's all right. I'm wanting to ask about a background question about what's at stake here, or what Mr. Beeson would have thought was at stake. Upon reading these briefs, it struck me that really it was only the 41 months that was at stake. There were three convictions with seven-year minimums. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So if you're only talking about 41 months and the person really doesn't want to testify against his friends or relations or whatever who were being protected allegedly by the coercion, that's a lot different from saying he forewent a chance to have a sentence a lot less. It's just a little bit less. And you answer that, you submitted a supplemental letter, mm-hmm. which appeared to address that concern. But upon further consideration, I wonder if it does. And that's the case that cites the Wooden case. But if you go and look at the Wooden case, they were interpreting a statute that didn't say, are these three separate crimes, but said, are these 10 crimes occurring on the same occasion? There's no language of anything like that going on in this case, is there?
Not precisely that same language, Honor, but
so
the point
if we would, to, just to follow up, to parallel this to the Wooden case, you would have to say that Wooden couldn't have been tried for all of those 10 crimes, but he was tried for all those 10 crimes.
The point of citing that in the letter was to rebut the point that the defendant had no, that basically it was in it, you know, basically a predetermined outcome that he was going to be pleading guilty and getting sentenced, that he did, in fact, have arguments that he could have made.
But what I'm suggesting is it doesn't really support that argument, because the argument doesn't hold water, because Wood is different. Am I right about that or wrong?
It is analogous in the sense that stacking three sets, 924Cs on top of one another in that case was interpreted to be all one occasion for purposes of that provision of the statute.
Right, but not that you couldn't sentence them for each separate violation of the crime, only that you couldn't treat them as one occasion for purposes of some later crime.
Sure, but that's something that he could challenge. He could make in other words, the point is just that he could make an argument, and it's not preordained that he would be
Well, I can't see how this would have supported the argument, though. That's all I'm saying.
We understand that, Your Honor. For the reasons I mentioned, we'd ask this court to vacate Mr. Beeson's plea and sentence and remand for further proceedings. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Naya Bedine on behalf of the United States. This court should affirm Mr. Beeson's conviction and sentence. As to the conviction, Your Honor, the district court made no plain error in accepting Mr. Beeson's plea. Mr. Beeson entered a guilty plea after he realized that the government had a strong case against him. And that included Mr. Beeson's own confession, a co-defendant's confession, surveillance videos from the robbery locations, physical evidence that was seized, and telephone data. Mr. Beeson was aware of the discovery and the proof against him. He expressed to his attorney, and he also expressed at the change of plea hearing, that he did not want to go to trial. In fact, he stated at least 8 times at the change of plea hearing that he did not want to go to trial.
That's going on in this colloquy with Mr. Garrett, right? I mean, that he's totally emphatic.
That's correct, Your Honor. His exact words were, in fact, I'm going to own up to the role that I have played. His motivation to not go to trial was, as he said, because he wanted to take responsibility for his crimes.
Any particular reason why the government didn't put in the record the recording of the phone calls between the aunt and the defendant when the defendant was incarcerated? Presumably you have that. Why was that not made available?
We don't have the recordings, Your Honor, but we do know from the conference that the court held that the gist of those recordings was not at issue. The government admitted that Mr. Beeson was talking to his aunt, and his aunt had some influence over Mr. Beeson. The defense attorney also acknowledged that there was some undue influence. In fact, the defense attorney stated that Mr. Beeson's aunt was trying to get him to exonerate his cousin. And of course, Your Honor, Mr. Beeson did not do that. Nowhere in the record does Mr. Beeson take responsibility for all the crimes.
And of course, the prosecutor said that he was concerned about undue influence of the aunt upon the defendant. And notwithstanding that, the judge did not personally question the defendant about that. Isn't that a problem?
Your Honor, I think the defense attorney said he was concerned about the undue influence that his aunt was having on Mr. Beeson because, she was trying to get him to exonerate the cousin. The AUSA, Your Honor, was concerned about the influence, but the AUSA told the court that having examined those phone calls, that there were no threats, no coercion made. As Your Honor knows...
Who's that you're quoting now?
I'm sorry?
Who did you say said that?
The AUSA said to the court that it seemed the aunt had some influence over Mr. Beeson, and the influence that his aunt had was whether Mr. Beeson was going to cooperate against the cousin. There were no threats made and no coercion made. That's what the AUSA said. Now, the defense attorney also said he was concerned about the undue influence. He put it in terms, he was concerned because the aunt was throwing Mr. Beeson under the bus, as he called it, and that the aunt wanted Mr. Beeson to exonerate the cousin.
Well, just to understand what was going on here, the defendant said that he wanted to plead guilty, but he would not testify against his cousin.
That's correct.
And the allegation is that that position resulted from the conversations he had had with his aunt.
That's correct, Your Honor. So yes, to the extent that Mr. Beeson's aunt had any influence on Mr. Beeson, it was whether Mr. Beeson was going to enter an open plea or a negotiated plea.
But the problem is that in order for him to have if he had wanted to plead not guilty, he may have needed to testify against his cousin. Isn't that the nub of the problem?
No, Your Honor. If he pleads not guilty,
in other words,
and he goes to trial, he still does not have to testify against his cousin.
Well, I mean, you talk about who was his degree of culpability versus his cousin's and all of that, all of the facts and circumstances, and that's what he was avoiding purported as a result of these conversations with the aunt, correct?
That's correct. So the, yes, Your Honor, so the, I'm missing the question. I think he, the gist of his conversations with his aunt was that it seemed she did not want him to cooperate with the government against his cousin. I think that's not disputed, but that does not make his decision to not go to trial, which was clear from the record.
We're not fully informed because we don't have the recordings or transcripts of the conversations with the aunt, even though those conversations were recorded, as I understand.
Well, we do
Should the judge have had an inquiry or a hearing into all of that?
I think that's what the judge was attempting to do, Your Honor, whenever he took the lawyers to his chambers to discuss the issue, and he was told by both lawyers that there was no coercion, that Mr. Beeson was fully aware of what his aunt wanted to do. He was aware of the penalties he was facing, you know, that he would get a more lenient sentence if he were to cooperate.
Well, that's not my understanding. My understanding is the lawyer said they were concerned about the aunt's pressuring of him, but of course he still wanted to plead guilty. And as a follow-up to that, the judge did not question the defendant regarding the communications he had conducted with the aunt, which is what the problem is, as I understand it, we're discussing now.
Your Honor, pressure is inevitable in a guilty plea context. We cited cases for that. The issue is, did the pressure arise to the level where it overcame Mr. Beeson's will and made him act irrationally about his decision to go to trial versus plead guilty? And he was, to the extent he was experiencing pressure, we submit, Your Honor, it was not overbearing his will.
How would the judge know that without conducting a hearing or some, an evidentiary hearing or some sort of proceeding?
Because the judge questioned the defendant at the change of plea hearing himself, then the defense attorney thoroughly questioned Mr. Beeson.
But the judge did not question the defendant about the aunt. He didn't ask him a single thing about that.
He was asked at the hearing, Your Honor, he was asked, did your aunt have anything to do with your decision to go to trial or to plead open? And he said no.
Well, the lawyer who was trying to get the plea accepted asked one or two perfunctory questions, but the judge never said anything to the defendant about that.
I think the entire proceeding, Your Honor, shows that Mr. Beeson was sufficiently asked about his decision to not go to trial, and he made it very clear. As I said, the what's important is to see whether the pressure that he was facing by his aunt was overbearing on his will, and whether that informed Mr. Beeson's decision to plead guilty. And we submit that he pled guilty voluntarily. He pled guilty because, as I said, one motivation that he had was to accept responsibility. The other motivation that he had was that he knew he was benefiting from the plea. He said that if I'm going to trial, I'm going to make it worse for myself, and I want to get out there to be with my kids.
Could I ask one question?
Yes.
To what extent do we know what a negotiated plea would have looked like?
We don't know the terms of the negotiated plea, Your Honor. What's on the record is that...
Well, if he was concerned about not having to rat on his cousin, is that just in his own mind, or is there some way in which the attorneys would have known that normally a plea requires that you testify, or we don't even have background knowledge as to what the stakes, what the grandmother might have been worried about?
Yes, Your Honor, we do know that what it would require of Mr. Beeson is to cooperate with the government against his other two co-defendants, one of whom was his cousin. So we do know
you could have a negotiated plea that didn't require that, right? There's nothing legally obliged. It's just a matter of practice that you would normally do that?
Well, I mean, Your Honor, I think in order for the government to offer him a more lenient sentence, he had to cooperate with the investigation. So whether that is...
Why couldn't you just negotiate a plea that you'll plead guilty and we'll drop this charge or something? There's pleas like that as well, right? But you're saying, that's what I'm asking, you seem to be assuming that the negotiated plea would involve testifying, or at least giving information that would be harmful to the other people. I'm asking, where does that come from? Is that in the rules?
That is in the record. No, no, it's in the
record. Where is it in the record? You understand what I'm asking?
Yes. Are you asking whether...
Well, I'm asking how much do we know about what the negotiated plea would be? And you first said, well, there's no, we don't know that. But then when I said, well, will it involve saying what you know about your cousin, you said, well, yes, it will. And I'm saying, well, a minute ago you said that it didn't say.
So I'm sorry.
How much is there that tells us what would be in the plea?
I meant we don't know the specific terms of the plea.
Right.
How
what
much
do we
of the
know?
Sentence?
What do we know?
We do know that it would involve him turning against his cousin. We do know
and
that
that's
much.
In, and how, where is that? That's in the colloquy?
That's in the plea colloquy, Your Honor. I don't think that's disputed. Judge, going back to the pressure from his aunt, there's another statement that Mr. Beeson made that's kind of telling about his train of thought as well. And he said, if that's the way to help myself, I don't want to help myself that way. But he also stated that it's not a good way to help myself if I'm still going to be doing time. So that shows a concern for perhaps his familial relationships, but that also shows a concern that he's weighed the possibility of how much time he's going to be doing, and to him, it is not worth turning on his cousin if he's still
dangerous.
Going to be doing time.
I mean, it's really dangerous for cooperators in prison. I mean, I don't know if that's what he's alluding to.
That's another motivation, Your Honor, that I was going to discuss next.
Very important fact.
The other motivation that he perhaps had to open plea instead of negotiate a plea was, as the U.S. attorney, as the USA mentioned, you don't want to be labeled as a rat while you're in prison. So that could have been another motivation. If the court doesn't have any more questions as to the plea, I'm going to move on to the sentencing. I only have 3 minutes. The district court did not abuse its discretion in choosing a sentence.
It's a plain error review here as well, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor, because nobody asked for a variance from the low end guideline sentence.
And nobody objected to anything we're hearing today.
That's correct, Your Honor. Nobody objected to the sentence. The defense attorney the guideline sentence was 41 to 51 months. The United States asked for 41 months, and the defense attorney did not object to 41 months. The judge went through the factors, considered all the relevant factors. The court considered the nature and the characteristics of Mr. Beeson. And, you know, the low-end sentence is presumptively reasonable, Your Honor. So for those reasons, if the court has no more questions, I ask that the court affirm the sentence and the conviction in this case. Thank you.
All right. We'll hear from Tom.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Erin Woodruff, and I would like to begin by reiterating the inadequacy of the Rule 11 inquiry in this case. Fundamentally, this is a case about process. Here, the court expressed significant concerns. Yet the court did not then engage in any meaningful colloquy with Mr. Beeson beyond asking him simple yes-no questions. Judge Kethledge, you refer to this as a record of conscientiousness, and the respondent has argued that the court did address these concerns with Mr. Beeson. But the only limited questioning related to the pressures Mr. Beeson faced from his family took place prior to the Chambers conference. It was not until Mr. Beeson first admitted to speaking with his aunt every day that the district judge called the attorneys into Chambers. Only then, in a private conversation where Mr. Beeson was not present, did the district judge say, quote, I haven't dealt with a situation where I may have a defendant who insists upon pleading, but I'm not comfortable with it. Do I have to take this plea? I'm not there yet. And only then did the prosecutor reference the recordings of conversations between Mr. Beeson and his aunt, saying, quote, we listen and we know the influence she has. And only then did Mr. Beeson's defense attorney say Mr. Beeson was being used and unduly influenced.
But this, again, I mean, it all goes to whether he strikes a deal with the government, not whether he pleads guilty, it would seem. And there isn't, you know, case law that says we have to have this sort of very extensive colloquy to make sure that his decision not to pursue an agreement in which he would testify is, you know, meets all these safeguards. It's about pleading guilty. And, I mean, if you look at the colloquy between him and Garrett, I mean, he's just absolutely emphatic. And meanwhile, he's confessed, and they have a mountain of evidence against him.
Well, as Judge Clay emphasized, following the chamber's conference, where these concerns were raised, Mr. Beeson's family was not mentioned once. Mr. Beeson was the only party who could speak to the pressures he experienced and the extent to which those pressures may have influenced his decision to plead guilty.
But, well, nobody anywhere here suggests that the aunt is telling him go to trial. Or I'm sorry, no, the aunt is telling him don't go to trial, right? Nobody says that. What it does seem to be, it does seem to be common ground that the aunt is saying, don't cooperate with the government in the trial against my son. I mean, I'll grant you that.
I don't think we have the record upon which we can make that determination today. What we do know is that what makes this case uniquely troublesome is that the court expressed concerns in that chamber's conference. And when those expressed concerns were raised regarding the pressure Mr. Beeson experienced from his aunt, the court needed to address those concerns with Mr. Beeson.
That's a fair point. It is plain error review, though.
And I would argue that we clearly satisfy plain error review. In Boykin v. Alabama, the Supreme Court held it was error, plain on the face of the record, for the trial judge to accept that petitioner's plea without an affirmative showing the plea was intelligent and voluntary. Here, the record contains no such affirmative showing. Mere assertions.
Well, I mean, I think the colloquy with Garrett is pretty affirmative and intelligent on the plea. Okay. On the plea.
Again, we would argue that Mr. Garrett and the attorneys made assertions that the plea was voluntary, but without inquiring into the circumstances Mr. Beeson faced with Mr. Beeson, there simply could not have been an affirmative showing that Mr. Beeson pled guilty voluntarily on that day.
Counsel, if the record, you can see, though, can't you, how we would be hesitant to say that because the district court expressed concern, said this is what I'm concerned about, I've got concerns because of this and because of that, that having said that is then going to get him reversed because he didn't act on those concerns to the extent that you think he should. He should have been quiet, in other words. Why wouldn't we be sending the message that when you have those concerns, you should be quiet about them unless you're prepared to rule in that direction?
I don't think we would be sending a message that we
but
should
why not?
Be quiet
it
about.
It seems like we would be sending exactly that message. Maybe we have to do it, I guess, but it would be sending that message, wouldn't it?
I think by vacating Mr. Beeson's plea, you would send the message that when a judge raises these concerns, rightfully so, that they address those concerns with the defendant so as to ensure that the plea was in fact voluntary.
Okay, thank you.
If the record in this case were to comply with Rule 11b2, it would be difficult to read that rule as anything but meaningless. If there are no further questions, we again ask the court to vacate Mr. Beeson's plea and remand for further sentence.
Thanks.
All right, thank you very much. And the case is submitted. And I would say, Mr. Parks and Ms. Woodruff, you both did a fine job. If this was your very first appearance before the court, so thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There being no further cases for argument, the court may be adjourned.
The honorable court is now adjourned.